The hour 10:15 have arrived. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Smith moves the minutes from February 27, 2025. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Smith. Okay, we have our agenda today. We're going to start out with an Addo bill, House File 633, then a Harder bill, Wienert bill, and then we go to the Davids bill just for some member comments if you want to. You don't have to comment. I don't know if you don't want to, but you sure can. Okay, so I will move House File 633, Licensed In-Home Children Providers Market Value Exclusion Credit. Representative Addo, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for hearing my bill. House File 633 is a simple, direct bill that lowers costs for family care providers. It reduces child care wait times, and it builds child care early learning system capacity. It creates a new property tax exclusion for licensed in-home providers that reduces the taxable market value by 50%, and hopefully it starts rebuilding our family care provider network. In 2011, Minnesota had more than 12,000 licensed child care providers. 10 years later, that number was 7,125. A license lookup on the first of this year indicated that currently there's only 5,782 active licenses. We've lost more than 50% of our licensed care providers. In 2021, the market rate for infant care was $16,164 per year. It was the sixth highest cost in the nation. We were seventh when it came to toddler care at $14,000, and we were second, only ranked behind D.C., for preschool kids at $16,000 per year. All families are struggling to find affordable child care, regardless of income. As the number of providers declines, costs increase, and wait lists get longer. And family care providers have been hit the hardest, and that's what House File 633 is trying to help. From 2000 to 2020, the metro area lost 40,000 licensed family care child slots. 37,000 of those were rebuilt with child care centers. We still had a net loss in the metro of 3,000 slots. Outstate family care providers fared worse, since large center-based facilities are less viable in less populated areas. Between 2000 and 2020, outstate Minnesota had a net loss of 20,250 child care slots. This bill is simple. It lowers the cost for in-home family care providers by $9.8 million. It provides $2.9 million savings to the general fund by reducing state-paid property tax refunds. It incentivizes new family child care providers. It provides stabilization and helps current providers. And it begins to rebalance the tax structure for in-home providers, as child care centers can now qualify as seminaries of learning for complete property tax exemption purposes under Minnesota Statutes 272.02. It was a court case, Rainbow Early Education Center versus Goodhue County. With that, I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Addo, for the presentation. Are there any witnesses that... Representative Hansen, questions to the author.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Addo. We talked about this in Children and Families, so I'm going to have some of the same questions I had before, because I don't see an amendment here from our last conversation. So can you help this committee understand how this is going to guarantee the lower child care costs?
Representative Addo.
Yes, it will lower the cost to family care providers by $9.8 million. So it directly lowers the cost that providers have to pay.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Addo. I understand that that's the cost that it would, you know, essentially offset from child care providers, but what about in this bill is going to guarantee that the people receiving this benefit are going to reduce the cost of child care by receiving this particular benefit?
Representative Addo.
I can't guarantee that that's the case. All this bill does is this bill basically creates a better environment for in-home family care providers to function. And as I mentioned in my testimony earlier, we've lost so many, and there is no one answer to try to rebuild the network of in-home income care providers. This is one thing that we can do that doesn't cost the state money that helps rebuild that network. And so I do believe that, you know, in my closing statements, we'll talk about the most cost-effective, affordable option in childcare today. We all know that it's in-home care provision. So the more we can bolster that network of providers, the lower our costs for childcare are going to be.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I guess that doesn't really settle my mind, right? If the goal is to guarantee this, we want to make sure that there is some guarantee in the bill language. I can't support it without that. I also am curious, how do you plan to really address potential fraud or abuse? I've heard from folks who said, oh, I'll just buy a house, tell my wife to open a childcare center, never take on any kids, and we'll get 50% off. How do you plan to address that? Is there a minimum number of children requirement, minimum number of participation in that? How do you guarantee a business be open for a certain amount of time? And how do you kind of plan to address those things that, frankly, I heard from folks on your side of the aisle?
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Representative Hansen. These are only for licensed child care providers, so they still have to go through the department to be licensed. If bad people want to try to defraud the state of Minnesota out of out of tax dollars, that's, as far as I understand, that's still unlawful. So there's nothing in this bill that would allow providers to get in and give them a leg up on fraud in child care in Minnesota.
Representative Hansen.
Unfortunately, thank you, Chair. Unfortunately, I don't agree with you because your bill doesn't require that they have a minimum number of kids, right? And so they could get licensed. I'm on the Children and Families Committee, so I very much understand the conundrum we're in about addressing the child care crisis. And our committee has done a lot over the last couple of years to address a lot of that. And so I understand the crisis that you're attempting to address. My concern is that for people who are looking to get 50% off of their property taxes, I don't see how in this bill it really prevents people from opening up and maybe only providing care to their neighbor's kid. Maybe it's even just one kid who's maybe at their house all the time. So I don't agree with the premise that this is going to vastly lower the cost of childcare. I didn't talk to anybody when I was door knocking who asked me to please cut, you know, pass off the property taxes for their child care centers onto the rest of them. They were all asking us to lower them for everybody, not just for folks that have these. So I don't, for what it's worth, as somebody who's been on the Children and Families Committee addressing this crisis for quite some time, I don't agree that this is a way that's going to help a whole lot of things. And I honestly don't think this one also has the votes to become law. So that's all my comments.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, and thank you, Representative Hansen. And I've only been on Child and Families for this session. This problem has been going on for decades. So I think that a lot of the work that we need to do in children and families needs to start addressing these things that we can change. You're right, this bill doesn't change any of the licensure requirements for in-home child care provision. Just like any exclusion that we currently have in statute, if you're a veteran or a family member of a veteran, there's an exclusion. And people are eligible for those things, or a market value homestead exclusion. You know, there is no requirements for that. The licensure for this bill will determine that. So thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, one last comment. I know I said I was done. I apologize. But I, on those credits or those exclusions, like you mentioned, there's limits. So like we talked about in Children and Families, I recommended there was a few things I thought you could do to this bill to amend it that might actually make it a little bit more palatable for this committee, and that could address some of the things that we're talking about on Children and Families. And so those other ones you mentioned, there's limits on there. So might you consider, you know, including some of those limits on there, including some of the things we've now talked about twice with the limits and the minimum requirements for kids, and a guarantee that it will actually lower child care costs and not just go into someone's pocket. Thank you.
Representative Nadeau. Okay. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You hit the name right there for it. Thank you for recorrecting. Representative Nadeau, I know you have some county experience, and I look at that as a value because you understand the coffers at the counties are light. Property taxes go to the counties. And even in your own statement, you just said this won't cost the state anything, but then when Representative Hansen mentioned fraud and abuse, you said, well, if they're trying to basically take away state dollars in that, then, you know, so I'm kind of confused about that. But one of my big things that I'm worried about, and again, in-home daycare, my wife and I, it was what we could afford. That's where our kids went. It was great experience. But I have problems with, and we were looking at the county coffers, because have you done any collateral research on this to see what the counties say about where this would land them taking away services, such as, are we going to have to look at more law enforcement? Are we going to have to look at cutting law enforcement? Are we going to have to look at cutting EMS? Well, we don't pay for EMS, so let's go to fire. So the bottom line is that I'm worried about county services, even in the small area that you're looking at, having to suffer from this. Can you kind of enlighten me on that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt. So to the first part of the question, I don't think there's been any fraud in in-home child care providers. I think it's been limited to child care centers. I can double check and get back to you on that, but I just don't think there's any fraud in in-home child care. As far as the county impact on counties, so yes, this is an exclusion. So ultimately, any exemption that's provided, be it a market value exemption, be it fiscal disparities, be it veterans exclusions, that share is increased on the people that don't get the exemption, and that's there and it's real. And what the impact of that would be in the fiscal note indicates that there's 5,400 current income licensed child care providers, and so I just talked with Hennepin County, and I will try to get that list to find out what that impact would be. But yes, there will be that share is shifted onto other property taxpayers at that level.
Representative Hewitt.
And Mr. Chair, just last statement is I appreciate that, Representative Udoh, and I would look forward to that research coming back, because, again, I'm just concerned with all the weight that we have coming down from the state and how we fund our schools, how we fund our public safety. When we're talking county coffers, I'm real sensitive about them. So thank you for answering my question, and thank you for looking into those things, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. It's definitely been an issue those who have employees know that that's a constant challenge, that they come into work and wondering whether they're going to have somebody to be able to watch their kids. As we continue to ask people to continue back to the office, we have to make sure there's places for those kids to go to. What I like about this program, and I think what it's doing, is it's, while it's not guaranteeing that the prices will go down, we also have to look at what prices may go up if we don't have them. We all know the supply and demand there. If you continue to have fewer and fewer, the prices keep going up. And one of the efforts of trying to reduce costs is to make sure they don't just keep going skyrocketing. And if we can come up with ways that we can open up and make it so people at home, I've heard a lot of people who are just closing up their home daycares. And so we need to make it more attractive to do that. And I believe I've heard in the past for many years that not having an increase is actually a cut. So I guess you can look at it that way when you're asking for a cut. The other way, too, is I'm getting a little confused, and maybe it's because I'm a newer legislator here, is when are we worried about fraud and when are we not worried about fraud? I just hear sometimes we, in some committees, well, let's not do something or let's not move forward to prevent fraud. And the next committee I hear, well, what about fraud in this situation? So we either care about it or we don't care about it. But I think this is a great program to start moving that direction, start addressing the many needs that we have for home daycares and families who are trying to and being called back in the office have somewhere for their kids to do it. And somebody who had their child in a home daycare, I think it's a great way. I felt they got great one-on-one attention, and I'm very grateful that I was able to do that with my children when we did. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Nadeau, thank you for, I think you and I always have conversations about how problems start, and we're just here to do our best to fix it. So I always think that you come very much so with the heart of really trying to see if you can address an issue. So I do thank you for trying to bring something different forward. I do just have a couple of really quick questions. And I just wanted to maybe understand, because I missed your beginning of this, so I just want to know, because this past year I was appointed to a group with Representative Robbins on the economic status of women, and childcare was a really big part of that conversation. And in our conversations, I hadn't heard of this as being something that childcare providers were asking for. I was just curious as to what was the information that sort of went into the decision of this approach. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I just wanted to understand maybe like what was the feedback that that led to this particular decision to bring this bill forward.
Representative Nadeau.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. So the companion bill for this in the Senate is a credit bill. I use the DE in child and families to turn it into an exclusion. I want both options to be discussed at the end of the day. There are some people that would prefer that we, you know, we provide a credit that there has it seemingly less impact. But in my opinion, we're going to have some challenges with funding this year. So I'm trying to move the ball forward in any way that's possible to try to rebuild this, to try to bolster this system, not rebuild it. Provide as, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, there is no one single thing that's going to solve this problem. This is one attempt that I'm trying to make.
Representative Herr.
Just a quick follow-up. And I'm not saying that there's a right or wrong reason why we bring bills forward. I just wanted to understand if, like, this is what in-home daycare providers were asking for that would be helpful for them. Because I know that the goal always is for us to try to reduce the cost to families, but also was this something that they were saying they needed or they were struggling with? I know I hear a lot about, like, the cumbersome regulations and how to, you know, to open up a daycare and how to stay open, and that's the challenges of theirs. And so I hadn't heard that this would be something that could be useful for them. So I would love to maybe at some point maybe just know more and maybe hear from them as this moves through committee for maybe have them. And maybe there's somebody testifying today who will maybe speak to that. But that would just be good to know that are we solving a problem for something that the people who are experiencing the problem are asking for. My other question maybe just is that, like in my district, I have a lot of homes that have been converted to daycares. And I've never asked them, like, well, do you live here? Or is it just a daycare that looks like an in-home daycare? And so I was curious as to, like, this bill, if the I understand that there's a, like, you know, if it's homesteaded or if it's residential, but I guess does it include people who might have these types of homes that are they look like an in-home daycare, but they may not necessarily live there, but it's considered but maybe it's residential. I've seen a couple of properties in my district where there's a house, but then also the daycare. And the way that, so like when we have sort of these complicated structures of like these in-home daycare, do they also get the benefit from this type of exclusion or, you know, tax break?
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Herr. I believe that it's based on the property class, and I will send this to Katrina or Jared just to clarify, but I do believe that the homeowners need to live there based on the property classes that we've drafted this for.
Okay. Mr. Swanson, you want to help out here?
Mr. Chair and members, the exclusion is tied to the property being classified as either 1A, which is a residential homestead, or the portion of an agricultural homestead that consists of the house, garage, and surrounding 1 acre of land. So the properties would need to be occupied and homesteaded.
Okay. Representative Nadeau or Representative Herr? Okay, thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Doe, I think this is basically a good idea. It could provide a meaningful incentive for new providers to enter the market. But I do share Representative Hansen's concerns about, you know, the auditability of the program. So I also serve on Chair Robinson's Fraud Prevention Committee. And the CCAP program was actually one of the first ones that we took up to look at, and had a lot of discussion there about, you know, the controls that are applied to prevent fraud on various aspects of that program. And it feels like I think Representative Hansen is right that we need some way of being able to audit: are these people really providing child care, that they're applying for the credit? And so I agree with her that the bill would be, it would be a better bill if we had some kind of auditability built into it as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Nadeau?
Yeah, and thank you, Representative Elkins. This bill doesn't have anything to do with that. And I would love to sit here and tell you and Representative Hansen that this is, that I'm going to guarantee you that there's not going to be fraud, that it's going to improve, you know, child outcomes, that it's going to reduce costs, but that's not, I can't, and I don't. And we don't do that in our education system. We don't look at our prison system and say that, you know, that we're going to spend money in our prison system and it's going to reduce recidivism. We don't look at our education system and say we're going to guarantee that every one of our students graduate in 4 years. That's not what this bill does. This bill is a simple bill that tries to lower the costs for in-home child care providers. That's all it is. The auditability component is outside of that. It's part of the licensure, and I haven't touched licensure in this bill.
Representative Elkins?
That's fine.
Okay. Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Nadeau, for bringing this bill to committee. The numbers that you brought up are really staggering, but it's really hard to understand them fully unless you're living out in greater Minnesota. We saw how daycare was changed with regulation and over-regulation. And those daycares that were run from the house, you know, whether it was an individual who was working a part-time job raising their own kids, maybe it was grandma watching a few of the neighbor's kids to help pay the bills. And we saw that attack on business, and then we saw how just crushing that effect was of those regulations. We've also heard in this tax committee a lot of times about tax breaks for big businesses. These are not big businesses. This is a small business. This is, most of these individuals are not getting rich providing daycare. They're providing an essential service across our state. When right now we have such a hard time, and our local communities are looking at pod systems and inside of the school systems, anything and everything they can to follow the regulation just to provide an essential tool to living. So a simple thing like what you're bringing forward, I think, is a step in the right direction. I would like to see some of the regulation that were put in place 10, 12 years ago to be lifted or repealed to help this industry out, because we are hurting in Minnesota. And to say that, well, we need to work through this bill, and we need to work through the process, and it's going to be years before this is done. At the same time, those people, and a prime example is in my small community, when a daycare that was run at a local parochial school had to shut down because they could not meet the requirements anymore, had to close. 60 kids were out of service. And yet I know that there are individuals in our communities that would love to have something like this to get their business started, to help watch those kids, their neighbors, nieces, nephews, whatever it is. So I thank you for bringing this bill forward. It can't happen soon enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we have two more people that have questions. We also have the mayor here on the harder bill who has some time constraints. So if we could get the questions quickly, because I want to hear from Mayor Carter, who has to leave in just a little bit here. So I've got Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am so sorry about being late. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for bringing this bill forward. What we have learned over the years is daycare does look different in every part of the state. But I'll dial back onto the tax issue, because I thought all of a sudden that we'd run into the Children and Families Committee. And we can talk about those issues later. I do worry about the shift on property, especially for smaller communities like mine and Hopkins that are 2 by 2 miles and have 65% rental. The shift onto residential would be very tough. I was thinking about ways to maybe narrow it down to start with. I am carrying a bill for non-profit daycares. Currently, if they own their own building, they get a property tax break. But if they rent, they don't. And I will hopefully see that later next week. And I'm wondering if you had thought about maybe narrowing this down to in-home daycares that take kids on assistance or can be a nonprofit because they take a certain percentage of kids that are on assistance with their child tax credits. So just to start with.
Representative Nadeau.
And can you ask, I'm sorry, I just didn't hear the last part of your question. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no worries. I tried to talk softly. I was wondering if you were thinking about, if you would think about narrowing the bill down to in-home daycares that can qualify to be a nonprofit because they take kids that are on assistance. And then also, and I can take this question offline with nonpartisan staff, how does this interact with the tax break somebody gets for running an in-home business where they can write off portions of their property taxes?
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. And I don't know the answer to the very last part of your question. The initial question that was talking about a property tax break for rental property, that's another bill that I think we're hearing in Children and Families, I think this week. It's a different bill. Am I wrong?
Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we can take this offline. I was wondering if you were going to narrow this bill as a starting point to in-home daycares that are nonprofits because they serve kids that qualify for subsidies.
Mm.
Representative Dole?
I will look into that for sure. And I guess my immediate response is, to me, it doesn't really matter if you're a for-profit in-home family care provider or if you've identified as a nonprofit. My understanding is the eligibility for receiving CCAP funds for those students or for those kids is the same. So I will definitely talk with House Research on that. Again, I don't know if I want to narrow it down too much more than 5,400. That's all we have. But I will definitely work with House Research and figure out if there's a way that we can do that and if there would be value in that. I would be more than happy to do it.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee, and then we're going to lay this one over, if I have the votes to do that, and then I'd like to get to the harder bill. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to thank Representative Nadeau for giving us an opportunity to talk about the child care crisis in Minnesota. I also used to be a member of the Children and Families Committee, and so appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. I don't really have a question. I think Chair Joachim already asked what I was concerned about, but I do want to just bring us back to Rep. Hansen's question about actually ensuring that there is enrollment. Across the board, we know that child care providers are distressed. It's an industry with very narrow margins. But as we've learned in Children and Families, like the largest cost is labor costs, right? And paying health care premiums for those employees. And so because of the investment we've made at the state, actually, according to the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, fewer child care businesses struggled in 2023 because of the investments we've made at the state level. And so My point is just I appreciate you trying to solve this issue, but I think the solution that would have a wider impact, right, would look differently, especially because as Rep. Hansen pointed out, there's no way to guarantee that a child care center that's larger, which would get a larger share of this exemption, would actually take on more children because we also have ratios to ensure that children are safe when they go to child care centers. And so we're laying this bill over, and I hope that the author will think more about, how to make sure that this bill has the largest impact and make sure that, kids can be taken care of and parents can go to work.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Does the department wish to weigh in on this bill? Okay, thank you. Okay, so I will renew my motion that House File 633 be laid over for possible inclusion in an awesome omnibus tax bill. I can just feel it. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Okay, I'd like to go now to Representative Harder, and I'm going to mix it up here just a little bit. Normally you'd have the author. Author, if you give a real short, and then we'll come back and open it up. Because I'd like to get Mayor Carter, if you could join us, Mayor Carter. So we're some harder moves, House File 457, and I'm aware there's a couple amendments we will take up. But I'd like to hear Mayor Carter's testimony since he doesn't have a whole lot of time. He has to get going. So Representative Harder, basically what does your bill do? And then we'll give you plenty of time after Mayor Carter leaves.
Thank you, Chair Davidson, members, for this wonderful opportunity. I will just give you half of what I was going to say, because I want the mayor, who is gracious.
And you can do the other half when the mayor leaves, so.
I'll do my other half when the mayor is done. So I'm very excited to share with you today House File 457, which would establish a new tax credit and grant program for expenses incurred in converting buildings from one use to another. So nearly one-fifth of office space across the country sits empty, with a record-high vacancy rate that's expected to keep growing. Seeking both to boost economies and ease the housing shortage, House File 457 encourages the conversion of these unused office space into income-producing properties. An example of a project might be a closed school converted to senior housing. So I'll stop there, Chair, and allow the mayor to give his comments.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Your Honor, if you could please provide your testimony.
Yes,
us mayors and former mayors have to.
That's right.
Yeah, yes.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. Chair Davids, or Mayor Davids, Chair Mayor Davids, Vice Chair Joy, Chair Gomez, members of the Taxes Committee, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of you. I do appreciate the flexibility given our time constraints today. I'm Melvin Carter. I'm the mayor of the city of St. Paul, Minnesota. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the proposal offered by Representative Harder to establish the CUB tax credit here in the state of Minnesota. 2 years ago, our partners at the St. Paul Downtown Alliance led an effort in partnership with public and private stakeholders to create a downtown investment strategy that drives density, vitality, and desirability in downtown St. Paul. Just last year in November, our St. Paul Downtown Alliance worked with Gensler to produce an office-to-residential conversion study. I believe you should have a copy of that report in your packets. Working with this organization, Gensler, we evaluated 20 office properties for the potential of converting commercial office to residential. It identified 10 of those 20 as ready and prime opportunities for office to residential conversion. Since the pandemic, across the country, across our state, and communities large and small, the hybrid work environment has resulted in the loss of employees working in offices in downtowns and office spaces. This has absolutely been the case here in the capital city of St. Paul. Currently, the overall vacancy rate for competitive office space in our downtown is just above 30%. That doesn't account for office leases that haven't expired yet, but employees are largely not working in the office. High levels of vacancy have led to devalued buildings and hardships for and closures of those businesses and services that were previously supported by downtown employees. Stagnant and falling property values place additional strain on local governments, forcing tough choices between raising taxes or cutting essential services like public safety and infrastructure maintenance. Without intervention, this tax shift will contribute to a cycle of blight, reducing property values and increasing property taxes for residential homeowners. I mentioned that 30% vacancy rate. By contrast, those buildings downtown that offer residential properties have over a 90% occupancy rate. When people have the opportunity to live downtown St. Paul, they take that chance. A key priority of that strategy centers around redeveloping those vacant downtown office spaces into housing. The CUB tax credit is particularly well suited at this moment to address significant issues that St. Paul and many other cities are facing. The credit is modeled in many ways after the Historic Structure Rehabilitation Tax Credit, which is also a very important economic development tool for local governments. We thank you for the reinstatement of that tax credit in the 2023 legislative session. This historic tax credit is a proven tool to stimulate job growth and attract private investment in St. Paul and across the state. This CUB credit will be another tool like that to build on these investments. It's very costly to reuse existing buildings, and the barriers to converting these buildings are significant. But we know that the cost to demolish a vacant building and rebuild new is even more expensive. With current interest rates, property owners and developers struggle to secure financing for major renovations. Upgrading plumbing, electrical, and HVAC systems, along with critical infrastructure needs like water, sewer, and safety improvements, require large upfront investments. This tax credit will be one of the necessary tools for these reuses to be feasible. The adaptive reuse of vacant office buildings to housing will create jobs, increase housing supply, increase the value of those downtown buildings and the downtown tax base, and increase our population downtown. St. Paul and the state of Minnesota are at a key turning point as we plan for adaptation of our downtown in post-pandemic. There's much to be excited about in the future of our downtown. We're currently in the process of building new parks, of refreshing our infrastructure and streets. We are at, like I said, 90+% occupancy in residential buildings, and we are hosting more events of global proportion than ever before. Events like the Frozen Four, events like the Minnesota Yacht Club Music Festival, certainly events like the state hockey tournaments and wrestling tournaments that are going on right now, and we're looking very forward to hosting the World Juniors Hockey Championship next year. At the same time, our community and other communities across the state are frustrated and impacted by a global dynamic of this shift to working from home that is beyond any of our local control. We need your help. This is an opportunity for us as a community, for us as a state, to do that old hockey adage, skate to where the puck is going. And I thank you for your time and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mayor. Questions? And members, if you look in your packet, there's also, we're very fortunate to have the mayor here today from St. Paul. But we also have a pretty strong letter from Mayor Jacob Fry supporting this harder bill also. So that's just so you do catch that. Questions, Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I have a question for the mayor. I agree that there needs to be conversion or something has to happen in both of the core cities with all the extra office space. How would this play into the whole issue of the rent stabilization ordinance that's been passed, and there's similar things in Minneapolis where there's essentially caps on rent increases, heavy regulation on that. And my understanding is that there's been very little housing built, rental housing, in either city recently, and this is one of the reasons. So how have you thought through just getting credits, but then you have this other issue where people don't want to build in your cities because of some of these issues. Have you thought through how this is going to play, and what's the future of that, too, Mr. Mayor? Thank you.
Mayor Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you so much for the question. It's a critical question. We've seen, deceleration of new housing construction across the country for lots of reasons, including high interest rates and things like that that we've seen over the past several years. You're very right that we have, particularly in St. Paul. I don't know the situation in Minneapolis as specifically as I do St. Paul, obviously. Particularly in St. Paul, we have shared with the community we want to build housing at a rate far faster than what we have been. This is one of those core strategies that would allow us to. We are building a significant amount of housing in the city, whether that's in the Heights on the east side, which is a former golf course, whether that's Highland Bridge on the, in our former Ford plant on the western side of town, whether that's downtown. We have two projects right now, Landmark Towers and Ecolab Tower, Tower and Plaza, which are currently doing a significant amount of conversions. We are in the process right now of working with our city council to do a, you asked specifically about our rent stabilization ordinance. We currently have a 20-year exemption for new construction, new housing construction. We're currently in the process of advocating and moving forward towards a permanent exemption for new construction in our city, which would remove that completely as a barrier to new housing construction.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions for the mayor before he goes on his way? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor, for being with us today, and thank you, Representative Harder. So I see that the bill would not really seeming to affect state-owned properties. So I just wondered about how much of the city's, you know, vacant office buildings are owned by the state, and am I understanding the bill correctly, that it wouldn't affect state-owned properties?
Mayor Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, thank you for the question. This bill is focused on like vacant properties, underutilized properties. So it would be focused on conversion, so a sale and a repurposing of that building. So we don't have, I'm not aware of any state buildings that are currently vacant right now. We certainly are working with our partners in state leadership to ask to continue to advocate for employees coming back to work and being physically in those spaces. Those buildings, as I said, the numbers that I just described do not include current leases for buildings that we believe are, I don't remember the exact words in my testimony, this doesn't account for office leases that haven't expired, but employees are not largely working in the office. So it's possible. I don't know the situation for state employees in every state building, but this would not anticipate necessarily taking state buildings and transferring them into housing.
Commissioner Robbins.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate that clarification. I am trying to ascertain how many state-owned buildings are empty or partially empty and what that is costing the state. So if you ever do, you know, have information on that and would share it with me, I would appreciate that, because I think getting state workers back to the office is really important, not only for the state, but for the city of St. Paul. And I support your efforts in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and welcome, Mayor, my mayor. Quick question for you around the conversion. So I've actually been talking to a number of developers who are very much invested in St. Paul, and they had mentioned to me that most of our buildings are so old that the cost to convert them is actually greater than the cost to just demolish them and build brand new. So I guess I was just curious as to do we know, based on, I think, very similar to Representative Robbins' question, is the number of buildings that are renovatable at a cost-effective way versus just tearing down the buildings and building brand new?
Your Honor. Mr. Chair, Representative Hurd, that was the point of doing that Gensler study that I referenced. Again, that Gensler study studied 20 buildings downtown and determined of the 20, as mayor, I learned lots of stuff that I'd never even thought about in other points in time. But, you know, different factors like how wide the floor plate is, how much, you know, it's going to cost to put to plumb individual units. Some of those smaller kind of floor plate buildings actually create a greater opportunity to kind of cut it up to in a way that, like, you have natural light and windows in every unit. Of the 20 buildings that we studied downtown, 10 were shown to be prime candidates for that type of renovation. So you're right, it wouldn't necessarily be every building. We do have a significant amount in St. Paul that would be prime candidates.
Representative Herr?
One follow-up. Thank you, Mayor. That's actually, I think, really important, because I think when people are thinking about what this would impact, they were thinking every building downtown, and the cost may not be what people are maybe imagining it to be. My other question is that the tax credit, and this is on me, that I probably should have been looked at the bill a little bit closer before we came in today. I just didn't have time to, but I do just want to understand better that, with the tariffs that have been placed that are going to affect today and future tariffs that are coming. I imagine, I talked to a developer yesterday who said that cost of projects will increase astronomically, and many of them have put a pause on projects that they are potentially going to do. They also told me that this is the lowest number of permits that's ever been pulled on construction this past month because of the uncertainty of what is happening at the federal level. I'm curious, and maybe you may not be able to answer this, maybe somebody on staff can, but do we understand that what we are proposing for this CUP credit, is it based on the cost of the project itself, or is it a set number of credits for a particular project? I would imagine that with costs going up, that a number of people, even with tax credits, would not be able to make the numbers work. And so I guess what has that played into the consideration of this bill, and is this the right time for it?
Okay, Your Honor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Herr, the bill is drafted, and there are probably are multiple people in the room who could speak to some of these specifics better than I could. The bill is currently drafted to represent 30% of the total project cost.
Representative Herr. Any other questions for the mayor? If not, we will. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Thank you, Mayor, for coming in and supporting this project. What have you learned from the businesses on why they are not returning? Just COVID's pretty overlapping. We're a few years out. Why aren't the businesses coming back to the city?
Mayor Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there's a broad set of kind of responses to that. One is that many of our businesses have come back to our community and are working there. I think one of the responses is that, we all learned during the pandemic that much of the work that we were doing before the pandemic didn't necessarily require everyone to be in the same room. I will spare you my mantras about how much we can gain when we're in the same space together and we're interacting with each other at water coolers and things like that. The shifts that we've seen and the trends that we've seen around people working from home are global shifts. They're global trends. I don't have any reason to think that there's something very specific about downtown St. Paul or downtown Minneapolis. And to be clear, there are a number of communities, as you will hear, across greater Minnesota and our suburban areas and things like that, who feel this same impact in different ways in suburban office parks and things like that. I don't have any sense that there's something unique to Minnesota that's making Minnesota's work from home trends necessarily different than the rest of the country or the rest of the world. I do think that the amount of technological tools that we have, the practice that people have gotten into over the past several years have just significantly impacted the frequency with which they go to work in an office space. Again, the opportunity to transition office space into residential spaces is an enormous opportunity for our city. It's an expensive opportunity for our city, but it's an enormous opportunity for our city to prevent the types of vicious cycles that we've discussed in this conversation in a way that stabilizes, again, both our city tax base, but also our statewide tax base as well, because clearly a significant portion of statewide tax revenue comes from our downtowns as well.
Representative Witte.
Thank you. And then my last question, and I might have a follow-up, is your police department back to full strength?
Mayor Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our police department is not currently at our full authorized strength. We're sort of always recruiting and always moving. We've added a second police academy every year. We are not at some of the low levels that we've seen some of our colleagues across the country kind of frustrated by. I think that's due to a lot of levels. We're very proud of the way they are continuing to meet our public safety mission.
Thank you, Chair. You got a phenomenal police department. I did my internship there. You started off by saying cuts to law enforcement, the impacts. If you're not up fully staffed yet, and we offer so much in St. Paul from the wild games, all that, that would be a bad policy, I think. And that's what I worry about, and some of these things are bad policies driving the people away. So I would be, I get that's an area that can be cut, but for me, when you got an excellent police department and everything they do for your city, it's an easy talking point, but reality is, we need to get them fully up there and retain them and retain the good ones.
Any other questions for the mayor? You want to wrap it up, Mayor, or to the Witte question?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that point. That's an important point. I acknowledge public safety because that's such a large percentage of what we do. And at some point, large budget cuts, there's no way to do large citywide budget cuts without impacting public safety. It should be noted that this year, the St. Paul Police Department's budget is higher than it's ever been, that we have invested not only in the police department, but in our larger public safety infrastructure. We've seen press just in the last week or in the last month or so about 2 years in a row of significant decreases in violent crime. We're very proud that in the last year, thanks to a non-fatal shootings unit that we built in the police department last year, we have almost tripled our case clearance rates for non-fatal shootings in our city. And we saw, I think this time last year, a national article in NPR about how St. Paul in particular was bucking a national trend where on average large cities saw, I believe, a 30% increase in auto thefts. And at that same time, St. Paul saw a 40% decrease. And so, I appreciate the opportunity to brag on our St. Paul Police Department. You and I agree that it sounds like that we have the best department on the planet. I see a lot of misinformation that we're cutting public safety or anything like that. I said that in the context of wanting to make sure that we can do everything that we can do to avoid that because so that we can continue the progress we're making on public safety.
Okay. Representative Witte.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Any other questions for the mayor?
Okay, thank you so much. I'm going to talk to Representative Harder to find out how you get the mayor of St. Paul and a strong letter from the mayor of Minneapolis on a bill. I'm going to work on that. So thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Representative.
Yep, thank you, Mayor Carter. And I just have some strong allies. That's what I have.
I guess. It's not what you know, but who you know sometimes. Okay, so again, Representative Harder has moved House File 457. There are two amendments. Representative Harder, is the A1 amendment yours, the 7A1?
Yes, Chair Davids.
Now, of course, normally we would pass these to get the bill in the way the author wants. So to the A1 amendment. And Representative Harder moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Davids and members. The A1 amendment allows the credit to be claimed by an insurance company against the premiums tax. For background, insurance companies do not pay the income tax. Instead, they pay the premiums tax, which is imposed at a relatively low rate on their premiums received. Currently, four other businesses have these income credits or offsets, as they are sometimes described in the premium tax, and that are available to insurance companies, and that would be the historic structures, film, housing, and short line railroad credits.
Okay, questions on the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Item next, who has the 0013 amendment?
I think that would be me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Chair Gomez, to the 0013 amendment.
Thank you very much. So the 0013 amendment aligns the affordability requirements, which are absent in this proposal in front of us, with the affordability requirements in the TIF article, I believe. So we have absolutely a housing crisis in the state of Minnesota. We have supply that is not adequate to meet demand, and that has an upward pressure on housing prices. And consequently, we talk about costs across our committees, and housing is increasingly, a bigger and bigger share of people's income, especially people who are living on fixed incomes. The governor's budget, which we'll treat with the deference it's owed, as Chair Davids has suggested, proposed no money for the housing committee, no enhancements. And so, we have made major progress. I think I'll say in my city, on our affordability goals and our production goals in the last few years. But we really have to ensure that when we are sending the people's dollars out the door to support housing, that we're meeting affordability goals. It's important, housing is a spectrum. It's important to invest, we need production along the spectrum of housing. As I explained to my friends who are like, diehard affordable housing advocates and are like, we should never spend a dime subsidizing a non-affordable housing unit. The way that the laws of supply and demand work means that if you don't build housing that is of the in the kind of middle income, even upper income bracket, they're coming for your housing. They'll come for naturally occurring affordable housing. And we've seen kind of these pressures on naturally occurring affordable housing, especially across the metro. So the A13 would just say that if we're going to spend this money, and I think it's like $70 million, sorry, looking at the revenue estimate, $60 million in the next biennium, it's escalating, that we should ensure that we're spending that money on housing that middle-income people can afford, and ensuring that when we send people's precious dollars out, I know that this piece of legislation is designed to meet multiple goals. It's not just about housing. It's about downtown vitality, tax base, all of the things that, that the mayor kind of talked about and that the letters express. But we don't want, public money to be subsidizing luxury housing conversions, perhaps. And so this is just an effort to add some income limitations to this particular tax credit, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question here. Do we have an idea of what this would mean for numbers? Like, what would the household income be, family of four? How much income could they have?
Representative Lee's raising her hand. I would have to go to House Research. I'm pretty sure she can explain, I think, Mr. Chair.
You're next on my list anyways. Here, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. So, yes. I guess this is the A23 is a cross-reference to ensure that housing projects that would qualify under this proposal would meet the same requirements as housing TIF. So there are two tests for that. There's the 2050 test, which means 20% of the units occupied would be for those whose incomes are 50% or less of area median income. So for like folks here in, I guess, St. Paul, because we're talking about St. Paul today, that would be about $1,400 a month. I gotta find the. Let me find my thing. That would mean that's kind of like the max that you would pay for rent, and so that's not a lot of money. And then the other test to meet this would be the 40-60 test, which is that 40% of the units occupied would be by individuals whose incomes are 60% or less of area median income. So, I was a co-author of this bill last year, and you know I wholeheartedly support the goal of our city to revitalize our downtown. But as you heard earlier, I think Rep. Anderson brought this up. You know, there is this rent increase moratorium in St. Paul, right? And our city council members instituted that because there is an affordability problem in our city, our county, our state, and across the country. And so I think this bill is a very good start, but if we are going to, do a permanent exemption for all new builds, I think it's a really important conversation to have to ensure that when we're using these tax dollars to convert buildings into residential housing, to make sure that we are actually solving the problem we want to solve, which is making sure that our neighbors are housed.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Any other comments on the amendment?
Nope.
To the author of the bill, comments on the 0013 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Davids and Representative Gomez. I have with me one of my testifiers, Dan Collison, who would like to address the amendment, please.
I'd like to address what?
The amendment.
Oh, okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Davids. My name is Dan Collison. I'm the Senior Director of Business Development and Public Affairs for Sherman Associates. We're a national developer, but based in Minneapolis in the Twin Cities, and of our many properties that include apartments and converting buildings, 70% are considered affordable according to the statutory setting of the limits. For this topic and this amendment, and I have further comments as we have time about the bill itself, the affordability crisis is real. We partner with multiple cities across the state, including Duluth and Rochester, and of course, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and suburban in the Twin Cities. And each local government also has their own desire and goals in inclusionary zoning, as mentioned by Representative Lee, in place. As we look at these projects in this bill, I think some things to consider, very important things to consider, that first of all, this is like a six-year timeline. And if there is an affordability requirement put in place attached to this bill, we have to recognize that developers will be required to also find low-income housing tax credit financing to match the converting of these buildings. And if that's in play, then we're working with the state agency appropriately, and it's typically 3 to 5 years to even get financing. And typically, the agency's qualified action plan right now is pointing all towards smaller projects, 40 to 60, no more than 80 units. And so ultimately, these projects, when you're converting large buildings, are usually 100 units or more, and would, in this case, for the next 3 to 5 years, not likely ever be awarded the low-income housing tax credits to be able to create income-restricted units. And so from our perspective as a developer, again, 70%, very committed affordability. That's, I think, the most important technical piece in relationship to the bill. The second one is that we work with the cities and will, of course, negotiate all development agreements to really push for as much affordability. And then finally, these buildings, particularly if we use St. Paul as the case study, when they are converted, in some cases, in many cases, especially if they're older, they will most likely be middle income. Now, I have a Minneapolis example that were in my original notes. 13-story vacant building has 20% at 50% area median income. But ultimately, the pricing of those units are all in the middle income, but not low income tax credit qualified required. So I just offer that to everyone's perspective to understand the technical aspect of you would be requiring developers, or essentially the development community then would have to have LIHTC financing to make any of these projects work if this was inserted into the bill.
Your thoughts on the amendment, do you support it? Or?
Thank you, Chair Davids. We really want to keep this credit flexible. It's a pro-housing bill, and we want to increase supply, and I'm generally not in favor of imposing more regulations. And so I respectfully ask the committee a no on this particular amendment. Thank you.
Any other comments on the amendment? Chair Gomez?
Just to request a yes vote for the affordability requirements, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, Representative Gomez, Chair Gomez moves the A25-0013 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. So, we have House File 457 as amended. Trying to get her back on track here. So, we will go with, is Erin Hannafin-Berg here?
Yes, she is here, Chair Davids.
Yes, I am. Thank you,
please,
Chair.
Please state your name and who you represent for the committee, please.
Yes, good morning, Chair Davids, Lead Gomez. My name is Erin Hannafin-Berg. I am with Rethos. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization founded in 1981 that leads people to connect to their shared places and spaces through preservation, adaptation, and activation. We've been serving as the lead organization for a coalition that's been in support of this bill for catalyzing underutilized buildings, and as you've heard, we've nicknamed the bill the Cub Bill. I want to begin by amplifying Mayor Carter's comments, thanking you for reinstating the historic tax credit during the 2023 legislative session. The annual economic impact study for that historic tax credit was just released last week, and it once again shows that this kind of tax credit program offers an incredible return on investment for Minnesotans. For historic tax credit projects that gained approval in fiscal year 2024, the state of Minnesota will award almost $58 million in tax credits, which is matched by federal credits, by the way. The 9 projects approved in FY 2024 will generate $591.5 million in economic output, meaning that for every dollar that the state is investing in these projects, there will be $10.25 of economic activity. While these projects are underway, the developers, their suppliers, and workers will also pay sales, property, and income taxes, and the analysis shows that these taxes will recoup for the state up to 43% of the historic tax credit amount by the time that the project is completed. And then once the building is placed back in service, the increased property values mean that projects often end up paying back more in taxes than was awarded in historic tax credits within 5 to 10 years. FY 2024 was the first year that the historic tax credit was available again after a 1-year lapse, and 9 projects were approved. In most prior years, the number of projects ranged between 12 and 14. I think that that demonstrates that it is a bit more difficult to get these kinds of projects financed in the current interest rate environment. And yet we will hear from other testifiers, as we have from Mayor Carter, that there is a need for tools to reuse a growing number of vacant and underutilized buildings in communities of all sizes. It's important to keep in mind that the historic tax credit program itself requires that buildings are listed in the National Register of Historic Places. This means that buildings are, in most cases, 50 years old or older and meet strict criteria in terms of their historic significance and federal standards for their rehabilitation. We know that there are many more types of vacant and underutilized buildings that are newer or not historically significant or too modified to qualify for listing in the National Register, and that is why we are proposing this new tax credit. We need an incentive like this to help communities reuse their existing buildings. The alternative is increased vacancy and disinvestment, local landmarks that become eyesores, and needless demolitions at a time when our communities have such acute needs in terms of housing and commercial reinvestment to stabilize our property tax base. We know that a tax credit like the Cub Credit works because we've seen its success with the State Historic Tax Credit, and we have every reason to expect that the same kind of economic impacts for this proposal. And we can imagine the possibilities for a whole range of properties put back to use, like vacant schools, shuttered nursing homes, idle factories, nearly empty churches, and of course, office buildings in small and large cities and suburbs alike. I urge you to support this bill and to make it a priority for passage this session. And I want to thank Representative Harder and Representative Kozlowski for both co-authoring this bill, and you all for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to provide any other information you may need to consider this legislation. And then finally, I want to note that Megan Shui, who is expected to testify, is not able to be here in person. And so she is planning on submitting her testimony, written testimony, and distributing it to you later.
Okay, if we could get that for the committee, I'd appreciate
it. So, thank you, Chair.
From Redwin, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, very good. Now, before the pages go, hold up. Tom, you thought you were going to sneak out, didn't you? I'd like to go down the list, your name, who your state rep is, we don't care about the Senate, your name, who your state rep is, and what your high school mascot is. Way on the left there, sir.
I'm the one unfortunately, I don't remember my representative.
What's your city?
I'm District
35A.
That's me.
Yeah. Now, Chair Stevenson, it begs the question, why didn't he know that?
Hey, it's my fault.
Okay.
I'm not on the district enough.
Okay, next. Shiner?
Like the black eye?
Angels generally don't hit people. What was your mascot, the first gentleman? Awesome.
My name is Henry Smetek, and I'm a representative is Representative Luke Frederick, and my mascot is a Scarlet, the Mankato West Scarlets.
Mankato West, all right.
My name is Sade, and I'm from District 31A, and my mascot
is a what?
Tornado.
Ooh, wow. Angels that hit in tornado. That's interesting. Who's your state rep? Who? Okay, next.
My name is Claire Jarnett. I'm from District 37A, and my representative is Krista Robin. And my school mascot is Zeus.
Oh, there we go.
Is what?
Zeus.
Oh, Zeus. Like, oh, wow. Ooh. Zeus. Wow. Yes. Knight, okay.
I'm Emily Burgle. My representative is John Burgle.
So you're still living at home. Okay.
And my state mascot is Gator for the PGMR Gators.
Gators, okay.
I'm Emily Nash. My representative is Jim Nash.
Wildcat. Well, welcome. I know that this is a great week for everybody, so thanks for stopping by the tax committee. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll see you. Now, another important question. When Mayor Carter was testifying, he was talking about the state hockey tournament. Are there any members of this committee that have teams in the state hockey tournament? And if not, why not? Nobody?
Oh, no. I think we. Rosemont has two.
No.
Rosemont?
Rosemont had two teams. They have the girls that did okay. The boys, I think, are still in it.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, so let's get back to business here, folks. Dan Collision, Senior Director of Business Development and Public Affairs, Sherman Associates. If you could please provide your testimony, please, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids, Vice Chair Gomez, committee members. It's Collison, but it always corrects to Collision on any typographical thing. I take no offense. I've come accustomed to it. So Dan Collison.
You don't talk about body shops or?
No, I don't. Okay. Although it tends to get marketed to me.
Okay.
I am the Senior Director of Business Development Public Affairs for Sherman Associates. I'm here today to testify in support of HF 457, express my many thanks to Representative Harder, co-author Kozlowski, for this Cub credit bill, and for which it has growing bipartisan support in that it'll bring public benefit and economic development across the state, incentivizing the adaptive reuse of underutilized and vacant buildings. Sherman Associates is a commercial real estate development firm based in Minneapolis with multifamily and mixed-use properties across the state, most notably Minneapolis, St. Paul, several suburban cities in the Twin Cities region, but also Duluth and a new project in pre-development in Rochester. 70% of all our apartment homes are designated as income-qualified affordable for seniors, working people, and individuals with special needs. Our firm recently converted two large vacant commercial buildings in Minnesota to housing. The North Star Center East building in downtown Minneapolis, delivering 216 new homes, with 20% of these being income qualified at 50% of area median income. And the Landmark Towers building in downtown St. Paul, delivering 187 new homes. Both of these adaptive use projects bring significant new value, vitality, and increased tax base to our state's leading downtowns. Both projects required changing the tax rate from commercial to residential. I know a concern of taxes committees, which is at a lower rate than commercial, yet both buildings' assessed values are now six times what they previously were as vacant commercial properties. So the property tax impact to cities, counties, and school districts is immense. These projects could not have been possible without the return of the 20% historic state tax credit. And furthermore, both projects have required significant tax increment financing beyond tax credits to make the adaptive reuse even possible. So if passed, this CUB credit could potentially ease the use of tax increment financing and bolster the tax bases of Minnesota cities that are now in some cases facing the steepest commercial property tax base declines since the 2008 recession. And if not addressed, will ultimately lead to a greater tax burden for homeowners to meet the ongoing needs of cities across the state of Minnesota. Speaking specifically to Duluth and Rochester, cities I love, our firm loves, we want to continue to invest in new housing and community-based projects in their downtowns where there are vacant commercial buildings, closed former schools, and other important existing properties for which the CUB credit will catalyze private investment and bring new projects and improve tax bases for those cities and, of course, the state of Minnesota. So in summary, Sherman Associates believes the CUB tax credit to be a most effective economic development tool to leverage significant private investment to meet this moment, to bring public value, and to meet the needs of our cities as they evolve to be places where more people want to live, as well as work and participate in the flow of city life.
Thank you. Any questions for members from Mr. Collison? Thank you very much. Is there anyone in the audience who should testify on behalf of the bill as amended or with concerns? Well, we have.
That's another mayor, Mayor Hanlon for the office.
Your Honor, welcome to the Tax Committee. I was thinking Hopkins. Do they have basketball there at all? Or
yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I was waiting for you to say that with when you mentioned hockey. Thank you, Mayor Chair Davids, and Lead Gomez, and members of the House Tax Committee for allowing me to testify today. My name is Patrick Hanlon. I'm the mayor of the city of Hopkins. I would like to thank Representative Harder for bringing this bill forward. I've been trying to track this down for a few months, so I'm glad we could connect on this issue. I also just want to echo some of the comments that were made on the, we're on the National Register of Historic Places, and the historic tax credits are an important tool for Hopkins as well for a small city like us. And that's really what I'm here to speak about, is that this is not only a big city tool, this is a tool for small cities as well. As mayors of small cities, we know firsthand there's a need for new tools for developers to encourage the conversion of underutilized buildings into new types of uses that our citizens and businesses want in our towns. This bill also builds on density value for our cities. There was a lot of mention with Mayor Carter and Dan Kalizan mentioned the tax implications. It increases value for our cities so that we also aren't fully staffed with our police department. So it allows us for tax funding to be able to get our services up to speed. And we have vacant buildings. So small cities like Hopkins are fully built out. Some of our small buildings now are in need of conversion to make better use of how people live and work today, as was mentioned by a lot of folks here, so I won't go into that. They're better uses not only for Hopkins, but for our region and for our state. Our community has felt the reduced need of employers have for office spaces. We have several large office buildings in Hopkins, including a 5-story building adjacent to our downtown that sits vacant. While the region faces a housing shortage, as was mentioned, and an oversupply of office buildings and spaces, we need flexible financing tools that this bill creates to help make space in our cities for more housing. Hopkins is a hot market. In fact, I think it's probably hotter per scale than St. Paul.
Careful now.
Can we banter? Can we not banter? Okay.
But I
mentioned that just that if we see a need in a city where we're really trying to get, it's a tough financing market, and if we see a need for this tool as people are trying to come in and build in our city, I can't imagine smaller towns and smaller cities across this state would also be able to utilize this tool. So for small cities and small towns, I think this is a really important tool. And again, I want to thank you. Thank you, Chair Davids, Lee Gomez, for your time today. Thank you, Representative Harder, for bringing this forward. And as you all work through the state budget session, I know it's not easy. So thank you for all the time that all of you put into the work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you. And when we mentioned small cities, I thought, to me, Hopkins is huge. You know, I live in a county seat town, 1,300 people.
Right, so, that's small. Yeah,
so that is small. That is
yeah,
small.
We're surrounded by big neighbors. So yeah, we're
so
small town.
Okay, so we talked about Minneapolis, St. Paul, and they have some buildings they're looking at that. Well, I think they said could do 180 units or something like that. How many units could that 5-story building next year downtown do?
Yeah, so you're talking about buildings that are like 30 to 50 units, that type of building.
And so this would really help getting those going. Okay.
Yes.
Questions for the mayor? Okay, thank you, Mayor. Anyone else in the audience like to testify for the bill or with concerns as the bill is amended? Any more member questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I'm trying to find out, maybe it's for the bill out there, is there a cap on the dollars?
Mr. Clayman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, this particular credit would not have a cap on the allocation.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you. I just want to point out that this bill, if it's passed, will literally pay 30% of redevelopment costs of any of everything in the state, okay, that would be under this. It's a huge amount of money, and it's very, very broad. And I'm not trying to shoot it. I'm just because I'm just going to get laid on the table. But it's 50% unoccupied for 5 years. I mean, you literally are talking about you know, on a commercial properties, converting, doing tenant improvements, you know, that this would be cover a third of tenant improvements on commercial properties. This would cover a third. I mean, this is a, I just want to point out, this is a huge amount of money across the state. It's a third, 30% of anything built. Okay, that's an existing building that's converted for the next 6 years. We're qualifying for it. So I want to point that out. So
Ms.
I don't
Templin,
know.
Do we have numbers?
A fiscal note. Oh. I think this is ridiculous. This was not. I just want to point this out.
Ms. Temple?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, yes, you should have a fiscal note in front of you that is does show estimated revenue impact of $11 million in fiscal 27, $22.7 in fiscal 28, and $36.5 million in fiscal 29. And Mr. Clayman is correct that the credit is capped. However, it is based on 30% of qualifying costs that are described in the bill. Mm-hmm. And I should also mention that the modeling of this estimate is the department used the historic rehabilitation credit, which is very similar in structure to the proposed bill, House File 457. And the cost for that credit when fully phased in is about $60 million.
Mm-hmm. Representative Anders?
That's all. I just...
Okay. Any other? Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, and Rep. Harder and folks for bringing this bill forward. I, just continue to want to ground us in the realities of where we're at with the housing crisis. Serving in the Housing Committee and here in taxes is one of the reasons why I wanted to be on this committee, because our state has continued to not invest in housing at the rate that we need. And as Co-Chair Gomez has mentioned, that the governor's budget does not have a single dollar for new housing. And so using all the tools that we can, I'm proud to have signed on to this bill. We know that, you know, and the Minnesota Housing Partnership has put out their 2024 State of the State housing. And housing is unaffordable to over half of our renters. And we touched a little bit on, like, rent stabilization and supporting our first responders and our workforce and in our community. And that's one of the reasons why I think this bill is a piece of tackling that problem. I think there are multiple things to get at. But when we look at cities across the state, rent increase on average by 8%. The cost that translates to the average Minnesotan is over about $1,200 a month. That is a humongous cut to a monthly budget. And so the way that we get at that is actually by building more housing to bring down the rents. We look at Minneapolis. Well, rents rose 8% in a place where they're building more housing, and they kept their rent increases to 2 or 3%. And so I think, you know, I've heard really loud and clear, my community's written in, our community actually has also addressed affordable housing, and so I do hope that we can continue as one of the co-authors to have that conversation, because we have about 108,000 unit shortage in Minnesota for what we need to build. And in my home alone, it's 3,600 units, and that's of affordable housing. And so for our renters of lowest income, we need to continue to lean in there. In our community, we talk about, we have a housing problem and not a jobs problem, because we have manufacturers and an aviation industry that wants to expand. And just in the past year alone, they told me that they turned down, they had 35 employees turned down really high paying jobs, high caliber producing for our community, and they're not able to expand because there's just no housing. The other thing is, I served on the bonding committee, and being out in our communities, especially out in greater Minnesota, we have schools and churches, we need community centers, we've got shopping malls that are sitting vacant, and these are all things that we can turn into housing, and we can turn into medical clinics and put them back onto the tax rolls and make sure that our communities are being served. And so understand that there needs to be more conversations, and I do hope that we get at that. I think my question I would say is, can this incentive be paired with other, for example, state housing dollars that you would be able to essentially tack on? Like, would you be able to qualify for Minnesota Housing, Greater Minnesota Infrastructure Programs, or those types of things in addition to receiving this credit?
Mr. Clayman, maybe? Let's go to research here. To the Kozlowski question. Mr. Cope?
Chair Davis, Representative Kozlowski.
Mr. Cope?
Chair, Representative Kozlowski, provided that the proposed conversion met the requirements for the housing infrastructure, for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency program, it could be eligible. To my memory, the only MHFA program that finances conversion is the Housing Infrastructure Bond Program, but there are at least some programs that could be paired with this credit.
Okay, Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. And for that response, I think that's an area where we can look at where there's multiple state dollars going and really look at what are those affordability aspects that we can drive there. I'm also really interested in, if I can, Chair, ask one more question. In South Carolina, there was the rate of 25%. In Minnesota, we're doing 30%. And I'm just interested if you could talk to, you know, I know we have some unique challenges in greater Minnesota with costs and with labor and other things. You know, there's a lot of rock we have to cut through, like up in Duluth and in other areas. And can you talk about what this would mean for greater Minnesota in terms of, as we're looking at inflation and other costs of it being at 30% as opposed to the lower rate of 25%?
Representative Harder? Mr. Collison?
Yeah.
Chair Davids, Representative Harder, Representative Kosnowski, thank you for these questions. When you do low-income housing tax credit product in these converted buildings, we can apply for state credits, and Sherman Associates has done that in Duluth properties. And we currently own and operate the Lincoln School, which has now 90 low-income housing high-techs and then 50,000 square feet of commercial space for nonprofits. That was a smaller cost project, $15 million. To this larger question of 25 or 30%, that extra 10% boost for this limited amount of time, so this is a sunset bill, is based on the current conditions of the market, the cost to develop, the cost of converting buildings themselves, and again, a goal of limiting tax increment financing to do that final closing of gap finances, which also, of course, negatively impacts the tax bases of the cities. And so for cities like Duluth, we have done analysis of the kinds of projects, the schools, the downtown, and in every case, it's that 10% that ultimately covers those concerns. And to the larger question of, now we're into a time of tariffs internationally, the cost of goods, it will even be potentially more needed to meet this particular moment in the in relationship to federal policy.
Representative Kozlowski.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and for that response and for the good work that you're doing in our communities. You know, I'm just, again, going back to the state of the state housing findings. This was the first year that law enforcement, nurses, retail, all of these folks that we see as like good paying jobs, right, who aren't able to afford housing in our communities. And so that's, I will be supporting this bill and continue to look forward to how we can continue to drive and spur this in our communities. People want to live where they can live, work, and play. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wiener, do you have a testifier, Ms. Madden? Do you have anybody else that's driven for a ways to, because we might not get to your stuff?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So let's go, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think actually, maybe in the interest of time, I will not speak and just let the lead close.
Hold on. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, thanks. Well, I wanted to direct the committee's attention to the revenue note, which Rep. Peterson talked about earlier. And I think she made the point that this credit is not capped. And I just wanted to actually, you know, thank the staff for doing a very good job of putting together the revenue note and kind of just bringing in all the data that they could. I was happy not to say anything just because I think most of my colleagues had already made the point that, you know, there are increases in costs because of these potential tariffs. And so we do need flexibility in the credit. This bill is being laid over. And so that I hope all the stakeholders will be able to talk about, you know, how we make this work, because we may not have a very big target in this committee, despite, you know, the merits of this. And then the last point is just, again, that the conversation about housing, the amendment earlier, right, would have ensured that people who make $62,000 a year are able to live in some of these units, right? And so I just think that's a very important conversation to continue having, because we will have a limited target. And if we are using public dollars to address this problem of housing and redevelopment, and, you know, we just have to be judicious. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Anyone else? Otherwise, I'm going to go to Chair Gomez and then to Representative Harder to wrap it up. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and thank you, Representative Harder, and the folks here to testify in support of this bill. It is absolutely a response to an issue that we're seeing across the state and across the country in this sort of transition away from commercial office space that we've heard detailed today. So just a few things. I mean, this is a Gomez-Anderson kind of agreement here, which I don't know if that speaks how you feel about that, Representative Anderson. But but I too am concerned with the cost of this program, with the fact that it's not only, it's uncapped for an individual project, as you see in the revenue analysis detail on the second page of the revenue estimate. The South Carolina credit was capped at $700K per taxpayer. That's not the case here. The overall amount is also not capped. So that means that this 30% of project costs that the credit is good for, as we are operating in this context, especially in our region of the Trump tariffs hitting all of these materials that we import from Canada, including, gas and oil and a lot of things, that's going to have an impact on overall project costs in our state, and it will have an impact, a potentially an upward impact on this already really expensive revenue estimate that we see in front of us. There's a letter in our packet from SEIU Local 26 that brings up issues around affordability, employment practices related to these projects, and sustainability. There's no requirements on any of these concerns associated with this bill. I mean, the other thing that I just want to say is, the historic rehab credit has a federal match. This does not. It opens up federal funding. This does not. The examples, Mr. Collison was kind enough to host me and a bunch of other members. I think it was at the North Star building, right, Mr. Collison? Yeah, so that was that, I think it was the 216 units. It's a beautiful building. They built it without this. They converted it without this. The 187 units at the Landmark Center, they did that conversion without this outlay of public money. They did use the historic tax credits, as was mentioned, which accessed that federal match. And, we don't have a formal but-for test for anything in our statutes besides TIF that I'm aware of. Maybe we do. But in practice, as people who make decisions about tax policy and decisions about outlay of public funds, that's a really important thing for us to think about. Would these projects move forward if not for this proposed $60 million in the tails? I don't know the answer to that. But when people make cases about it, we have to understand the different incentives at work, I guess I would say. This is a very expensive answer to a very expensive problem that our cities are facing. I think that, there's more conversation to happen about this, but, we're going to be in a very, in a tight budgetary situation, as our Ways and Means Chair continues to remind us incessantly. If you think the last one was bad, stay tuned for Thursday. There will be more conversation about this moving forward. This is a real issue. It's not just about housing. We know that it's about downtown vitality. It's about tax base. It's something that could ease the use of TIF. There's no guarantee of that. When we talk about those benefits, we really want to make sure that they are like in the bill language. So more discussion to come on this. In its current form, I do have reservations about the cost of it. About the lack of caps, both on the individual project cost and the overall cost, but sort of the omission of some of the sustainability, affordability, and labor concerns that are brought up by some folks in our community. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you'd like to wrap it up, Representative Harder.
Yes, thank you, Chair Davids and committee for hearing this bill. Like I said, it's pretty exciting that it'll help housing all across the state, which is the beauty of the bill, to help convert vacant and underutilized buildings into spaces that meet today's needs. So the bill will also help create jobs, increase housing supply, and increase the valuation of buildings. So think of your district and cities and the potential that buildings could be revitalized. And I just want to give you a short story of myself, of a building that had a furniture store at the bottom, and above it was office space. And those offices were converted to housing. And there were 15 apartments in that particular building. I just want to describe the apartment that I got, not to make everybody jealous, but this is pretty cool. So the apartment that I got out of this revitalized building, it was 1,200 square feet. It had 15-foot ceilings, skylights, marble floors, and countertops. I really thought that I should be on the show Lifestyle of the Rich and Famous. If you're old enough to remember that, that's where it belonged. And just keep in mind that this was years ago. For this 1,200 square foot apartment, I paid $450. And so you can see by today's standards that, yes, the cost of apartments are really getting out of reach. So I just feel that this bill is a win for the community. It decreases blight, helps improve the vitality of our area, and it also promotes economic balance, invests in infrastructure, and is flexible to meet the market needs. And so I thank everybody today who came to testify, your comments, good or otherwise. I just appreciate that. So thank you, Chair Davids.
Well, thank you. So Representative Harder moves that House File 457 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So we're going to lay that over. Members, good discussion today on the bills we had. Keep your green folders here for House File 812, the Wiener bill. That will be first on the agenda. I apologize, Representative Wiener, we didn't get to that. It'll be first, and Nan Madden, who's Nan here?
Yeah, he's over there.
Can you come tomorrow? You're first. Okay, thank you. And then the Davids bill, House File 1270. So keep the information at 1277. Keep the information on those. Anything else for the good of the order? Good government all the time. We adjourn. Yes.